So I'm going to start. I'm Matt. So first of all, I want to thank whoever made us follow the social engineering session. Thanks a lot. We're going to talk about hacking voting systems, and we're being a little careful not to use the word voting machines, because voting machines get a lot of the attention, but in fact these are part of much, much larger, much more complex systems that need attention just beyond the machines themselves. So I just want to start out a little bit and go kind of back to Schoolhouse Rock level civics class and talk about some of the requirements for voting in elections. And I'm just going to work backwards from this this phrase, one person, one vote. Has anyone heard that before? Where is that from? It's in the Declaration of Independence, right? Or the Magna Carta? Or the Constitution? Nobody knows where it's from. It's a slogan. But it is what we have kind of taken to mean what a democracy, a property of democracy, should have. And when you drill down, it's not actually a very useful set of instructions. I mean, first of all, vote for what? Mostly what we vote for are officials rather than individual issues or things that the government is doing. We have a representative democracy. The idea of a person, one person means basically your vote is supposed to be based on your personhood, but not other qualifications. Except, of course, we generally only allow citizens to vote. So it's actually not one person, one vote. It's really one citizen, one vote. It's really evolved over time in the US. The phrase used to be one man, one vote. Eventually we expanded that to include, the other gender that might want to vote. So we now say it's one person, one vote, and we now let people who, are of all skin tones vote and so on, but that wasn't originally there. So these principles all have evolved over time, the requirements for elections. And it also has been understood to involve more than just the eligibility to vote, things like access to the polls. Are you going to be able to vote? Are you going to have an equal opportunity to vote with everyone else? As well as some assurance that your vote is actually going to be counted accurately, which is something that technology has something to say about. So if we take a look at what some of the actual requirements for achieving this are, you could come up with a lot of them. And in fact, over time, we have come up with all sorts of nuanced understandings of what we need to do in order to achieve the ideal of one person, one vote. And a few that I want to highlight, this is not the authoritative list. This is stuff I made up when I was writing up this slide that is kind of included in this. But I want to point out that these requirements range from very broad, and political level things. Who is allowed? Who qualifies to be a voter? Which are sort of fundamentally political questions. But also some things that look like technical requirements. One is secrecy, the idea that your ballot is secret. No one can find out how you voted. No cheating. You can't cast more than one vote, and you can't prevent other votes from being counted. Those have a lot of interaction with the technology and the protocols used for conducting elections. And ultimately, what we want to achieve is not just picking who wins, but having public confidence in that outcome. That is, it's not just about picking the winner, it's also about convincing the loser that they've lost. That's a pretty amazing thing that we've gotten a little over 200 years and mostly have achieved that, right? We've mostly not had two people try to take office simultaneously and have, you know, the army support one of them and the navy support the other and the post office supporting somebody else or anything like that. And those things do happen in a lot of countries that aspire to democracy. Anyway, if you try to take a look at what the one person, one vote means in more precise terms, the best I can come up with is one adult citizen, one easily exercised but non-transferable option to cast a secret, accurately counted vote after a fairly conducted public campaign that will determine who their representative is. But that's not as catchy a slogan as one person, one vote. Okay, so technology has comes into play here. Early U.S. elections actually were pretty informal, and they consisted not much really of people in a room raising their hands. We stopped doing that just because it was not secret, but because it wasn't really practical. It didn't scale. So it was really scalability that was the first driving requirement for using technology in elections. And of course, the first technology that we kind of moved to was paper and pencil. And those mechanisms interact with the requirements and our understanding of the requirements for conducting elections. Now, why am I talking about requirements? Because as technologists, if we're asked to build systems, the first question we have to ask is, what's the system supposed to do? What are the requirements for it? And that's a very important and difficult question to ask about election systems. So we've evolved through a number of technologies, ranging from paper ballots that are marked by people to machine-readable ballots, machine-counted ballots, something called direct recording voting machines, and then more recently, voting computers, which are sometimes called direct recording electronic voting machines, in which you cast your vote basically on a touchscreen terminal. And those are, fortunately, and thanks to some of the work that we're going to be talking about here, starting to fall out of favor. An interesting property of technology in elections is the most skeptical people about the use of election technology overwhelmingly are technologists, right? The computer scientists are the people most loudly saying, what, you want to use computers for this? Are you crazy? That hasn't stopped computers from making significant inroads into elections. So one of the things that you'll notice is that some of the requirements are in conflict with each other. And that's, that should be you need to come up with different requirements, but these are the requirements. And I want to highlight two really difficult requirements from a technology point of view. The first is we have a requirement for both secrecy and a requirement for transparency.
Can I tell a story about this?
No.
Never mind that.
Okay, go ahead.
So there's an actual example of this conflict. The state of Pennsylvania, and this was in 2007, bought a bunch of machines that were for electronic voting machines, and they had printers attached to them. These printers had a serial number and a timestamp. Pennsylvania had a state requirement that there had to be a printer attached to every electronic voting machine. Now, federal law has a requirement that you can't match voter to vote cast, both to stop extortion or blackmail. You know, vote the way you want and bring out proof that you've done it, or I'll break your kid's legs, or to stop vote selling, which America has a long history of. So, the problem with the timestamp is that voters also had to sign in, which was also timestamped. So you had the ability to match voter with vote cast. So it violated federal law. So they changed their law to say, yes, you have to have a printer attached to these machines, but you couldn't use it. I'm not making
that up. There you go. Right. So why do we have these requirements? Well, one of the reasons we have the requirement for secrecy is because we don't want people to be able to sell their votes. But more importantly, we don't want people to be able to be intimidated into voting in a particular way or not voting in a particular way. So the secrecy requirement is particularly strong. That is, it's not only shouldn't somebody nefariously be able to find out who you voted for, but you shouldn't be able, you should not have any means to prove who you voted for, even under duress. That is, we sometimes call that receipt-free voting. You shouldn't be able to, there shouldn't be anything that documents how you vote, even with your cooperation, so that you can't be forced to vote in a particular way and you can't easily sell your vote. So that's one requirement. And at the same time, we want to be confident that our vote got counted. And how do you do that? You don't get any kind of receipt for your vote, and you want to be sure that it was included in the final outcome. From a technical point of view, that sounds hard, and it kind of is. And then there's a second difficulty, which is that in general in the United States, it is essentially impossible to have a do-over in an election. That is, we hold an election and count the results, and that's the outcome. There's almost no constitutional mechanism, except in incredibly extraordinary circumstances, for saying, oh, we detected irregularities in the election, we have to invalidate the outcome and hold another election. We basically can't do that. And there are sometimes requirements that the election has to be certified by a particular date, and there are other requirements that just make it effectively impossible to do that. And what does that mean? Well, it means that any security mechanisms you have can't merely detect irregularities. They have to prevent irregularities. Because just detecting an irregularity doesn't actually help you. You have to be able to recover the true result.
And detecting irregularities may actually end up with them not counting those votes at all. That's happened in a number of cases. I can give you some examples later.
Yeah. So in the U.S., there is a long and colorful history of fraud in elections. Elections have high stakes. People, for some reason, want to be elected to office. That, by the way, we think about presidential elections, but in fact, a large fraction of the history of fraud, of fraudulent candidates, people trying to buy votes, is for local offices, mayor and sheriff and so on. In particular, we generally spend a lot more money on campaigns for elections than we do actually conducting the mechanics of the election itself. So the we're kind of outgunned. The candidates who want to win have more resources at their disposal than the people running and protecting the elections. There has been a long history of fraud, and it's mostly been people trying to get themselves or their favored candidate elected or prevent somebody that they think is bad from winning, sometimes with money changing hands and so on. But we have a new element of that threat model that hasn't really historically come into play in the U.S., which is state actors, other countries, intelligence services, like, countries rhyming with Musha, who might want to disrupt an election. And an interesting thing about a state actor is they have both more resources, they're big and well-funded, they're willing to commit crimes in the country they're operating in, and they actually have an easier job because they may get what they want, not necessarily by picking the winner, but merely by disrupting the electoral the electoral process and reducing confidence in the public's outcome and harming the legitimacy of the elected government. So, in other words, denial of service attacks against election are part of the threat model. Denial of service is tough. And elections are tough already, even without that. So this is a really, really tough problem. Okay, voting in the U.S., voting is highly decentralized. The federal government says remarkably little about how elections are conducted. In fact, if you look in this handy document that I just happen to have right here, I would say I have it in my breast pocket, but I'm wearing a t-shirt. The Constitution is where most of the federal government guidance on elections are. And it basically says things like, not a whole lot. "The times, places, and manners of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed by in each state by the legislatures thereof." That's it. So in other words, states are, in the Constitution, given the latitude to figure out how to conduct elections there. And for this is in Article 1 and Article 2, the presidential part of the Constitution. It basically says the manner of selecting electors for the Electoral College will be, you know, same language. So there's not a lot here. The 14th Amendment also says something about the rights of people in any state, you know, get federal rights, and that's where the authority to have things like the Voting Rights Act come into play. But mostly, these we're talking about states coming up with the rules. There are 50 states, which means there are 50 sets of rules, plus possessions and the District of Columbia. So we have a large number of slightly different sets of rules. And elections are, in fact, actually operated in almost every state by individual counties. And there are 3,000 counties in the US, roughly. So essentially what this means is there are somewhere between 3 and 4,000 different, slightly different sets of procedures, slightly different sets of rules, slightly different equipment, slightly different everything for conducting elections. So when you say, well, all we have to do to fix voting is this, who is the we you're talking about? Because it's a lot of different entities in the country. Here's a quick history question. Does anybody recognize this picture? What's this from? The Florida recount. In what year was that? That was like 1970, right? Yeah. Seems like so long ago. No, the 2000 election. This was the most famous picture probably from the Florida recount. And what we saw, this picture has had an interesting thing happen with it, which is that it has inverted its meaning in the 18 years since it was taken, 17 and a half years since it was taken. This was originally a picture to show how unbelievably, laughably stupid the Florida people were, that they were using this old-fashioned punch card system that you would have to hold up to the light to see where a punch card was and look at this antiquated technology coming back from the 1950s. And today, this picture is almost always used to illustrate, look at the strength of the system. If you're not sure what the outcome was, you can take the punch cards and hold them up to the light and try to figure out what the actual voter originally intended to do. Try to do that with a memory card. This was a recount of an election, an audit of the election to try to determine the voter's original intent. A quick story about this technology. This is a Florida, actually this one is from Wisconsin, but it was the same technology used in Florida, voting punch card voting machine. Essentially what you would do is take that little stylus, put a card through the top of the machine, take the little stylus and punch on each page of the ballot a little hole through the card. And the card was actually a perforated punch card, much sort of like an IBM punch card machine card, but a little different because it had these perforated rectangular holes in it that would fall underneath the holes in the machine that you would push the stylus through. And the little pieces of rectangle called chads, a word we all learned in 2000, would be pushed to the back of the machine. And so an interesting thing happened. This was a completely mechanical system. The voting machines would have to be plugged in, but the only reason they had to be plugged in because there was a little light on them so the voter could see what was going on. Otherwise, they were completely mechanical devices. So it was a completely mechanical device with a buffer overflow in it. What happened? Well, because of conservation of matter, a physical law, the little chads of paper, when you vote for somebody, go somewhere. Where do they go? Well, they go right behind where they were because you're pushing them through with a little stylus. What happens? Well, in most elections, about 100 people would vote on any voting machine in any given day. In the 2000 election in Florida, there was enormous turnout. And so in some places, 300 people would vote at a place where normally the maximum was like 125 or so. And so what happened was that these pieces of cardboard, as they get punched out for the more popular candidate, would back up in the machine and behind the little plate where you'd put it in. And so the more popular candidate late in the day, it'd be really easy early in the day, late in the day, the more popular candidate would get harder to vote for because you wouldn't be able to necessarily get the stylus all the way through. And so what would happen is, if you take a look at it in the upper right, there is a fully punched hole. But down toward the middle, you'll see there was one that's just dimpled because the senior citizen in Florida wasn't quite able to muster the strength to push through behind all of those backed up pieces of Chad. An actual buffer overflow attack in this. The other possibility was there might be a little flap. You might not punch it out completely, called a hanging Chad. That was a dimpled Chad before. This is a hanging Chad, terminology that was not as widely known prior to the 2000 election. So what happened? Well, we got a president because they basically eventually just stopped recounting. It was razor thin. If you look at the Bush v. Court, Supreme Court case, it's very depressing. But basically, they said, it's up to Florida. You figure it out. And we got a new president, but Congress did a bipartisan thing. They passed something called the Help America Vote Act. And it was hurriedly passed after 2000, became law in 2003, and it basically mandated that states move away from this old-fashioned voting technology if they wanted a giant pile of money that Congress allocated for new modernized voting machines that would be accessible for the disabled. And that basically meant machines with assistive technology like touchscreens, which Congress allocated a giant pool of money for that states could draw from to buy it. The one problem was that at the time the Help America Vote Act was passed, there really weren't machines to buy. So what happened? Well, industry stepped up and produced as quickly as possible voting machines that would comply with the Help America Vote Act for states to buy. And these were just as high quality as you could imagine under the circumstances. Basically, there were three classes of these machines: direct recording electronic machines, touchscreen voting machines. It would also allow for optical scan machines as well as absentee ballot machines. A lot of the attention goes to the direct recording electronic machine. This is a particular model of these machines. Okay, basically, you've probably heard these machines are terrible, and they are. So in 2007, Harry and I both participated in studies for the states of Ohio and the states of California, where we examined these machines along with other teams. I led a team that Sandy Clark was on in Philadelphia. I also led a team out at Berkeley. Hari led teams at wherever Hari is. And we looked at basically every currently manufactured machine, and we found essentially from top to bottom that these machines were unbelievably horrible. I think one of the things we mentioned in the report that I wrote was the only good thing we can say about them is there's no toxic material in them when they end up in the landfill. That turned out not to be true. They use lead acid batteries. They have security vulnerabilities literally in every interface. We found buffer overflows in every input interface. You could if you tampered with a voting machine, you could propagate virally to the back end and then hit every other voting machine by the next election and have it running your own firmware. It was unbelievably, and every vendor basically had these horrible problems. Okay, so people have been raising questions about these voting machines. Here's one little problem. The only people who have been allowed to look at these machines up until incredibly recently were people who got special permission. People like me and Hari, you know, so-called respectable official people who would be contracted by states and given access to these machines. And if you tried to get them, they would say, get lost. Or if you're not lucky, they'd say, see you in court. So a couple of things have happened since then. First, a lot of these machines have gotten past their end of life and have ended up on the surplus market. And so you can go on to eBay and for a few tens of dollars buy voting machines, which we've done. And you can do it too. And also, amazing thing that happened 4 years ago, we got an exemption to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act for good faith security research and testing. How many are familiar with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act? We all hate it, right? But there is an exemption, and it's got renewed, and it's presumptively going to get renewed going forward, that basically says good faith security testing of consumer products, comma, including voting machines, comma, is exempt as long as you aren't doing it for the purpose of copyright infringement per se, which basically somebody doing a security evaluation isn't doing. Call your lawyer before you do this. But basically, it's a really great protective law for us. So all of a sudden, voting machines are available. Voting systems are available because we can buy them for cheap used. And there's now a law protecting us from reverse engineering them that particularly calls out security testing of voting machines. So what did we do? Well, last year, there is a hacker conference, another one besides HOPE. It's a small gathering in Las Vegas in August called DEF CON. Some of you may have heard of it. Last year, we bought a bunch of voting machines and decided to have the Voting Machine Hacking Village, where we invited people, basically for the first time, to come and hammer on voting machines. And the only rule was, feel free to break them. And we basically opened it up for a weekend, and what we discovered was that all of the things that we secretly found when we had permission to look at them, the hacker community found much more quickly than we did. When we opened it up to more people, we discovered, it turns out, the crowd really is good at finding vulnerabilities in systems. They basically were able to confirm everything we discovered. A couple people found some new things. We discovered a Wi-Fi interface in one of the voting machines that nobody knew about before. And one of the used voting machines also had live data in it. So that was a lot of fun. And we are going to do it again this year. With that, let me turn it over to Hari, who will tell you a little bit about some of the stuff that we found last time and what we're hoping to do this time.
Can I have the
HDMI? No. Bring your own.
Okay. There you go. So it's an interesting story. I was doing my favorite thing, drinking beer. And while drinking beer with Margaret, who is one of the organizers, she said, well, this is weird. Tark Tangen just tweeted that there will be a voting machine hacking village. So that's weird, because we are now in like 6 weeks before DEF CON, so it's very late in the game. I wonder who is going to be the idiot running it. And behold, 2.5 hours later, a telephone call comes in. Yeah, we're thinking if you would. Matt already said yes. Would you be?
What I said, what you told me was, Hari already said yes.
That's how the con artists and social engineers work. Anyway, so that's how I got involved. And I'm a little bit recapturing. I'm not going to read through the slides. But I'm also telling a little bit my own personal story. I was 2004, going around a world trip. I had sold my company. I was retired. Completely, no, not going to be here anymore. The cable is probably... It's green. It's different, wrong color. Anyway, it doesn't matter. And I was asked if I would be interested in voting, hack voting machines. I say, hell no. Off to Tahiti. They kept pestering me. And until then, I made an impossible set of rules, saying I need to have an invitation, permissions from election supervisor, who is elected, not appointed. I need to have an indemnification because DMCA was still around, etc. And I say, done. That's never going to happen. 4 months later, I got a call from United Kingdom. I say, oh, you have an invitation to Ion Shancho. And turns out Ion Shancho was the guy who was responsible for year 2000 recount. So I went, looked a couple of things, found out that there are vulnerabilities in central tabulator, and then said to Ion, well, this is not elegant. And what do you mean it's not elegant? Said, well, this will leave forensic evidence. So, well, that's is there elegant ways? I don't know. But if there is, it have to be on this memory card. And the vendor had told that this memory card is proprietary technology by them, and nobody else have it. I said, no, lying. I've seen this guy before. Well, long story short, had more beers, pulled out the patent of the original laptop computer by Tandy. This was predating floppy disk. This same disk is the floppy disk in that. It's a battery refresh SRAM, very old technology. And then I found out it was made by Epson. Epson had discontinued, and I found a company who is spraying corn in Minnesota with a radioactive isotope, measuring the growth by decay and using this memory card still today. So that's how I got the reader. Anyway, that was how the whole thing started. Secretary of State California then commissioned a first study where the UC Berkeley, led by Professor David Wagner and David Jefferson, verified my findings and found 13 more things which I didn't find, which then led to the studies where Matt and I, me and Sandy and many others have been having the pleasure to work and find out. And the saddest thing this is that when we started exposing this from 2007 to 2008, we actually believe this is going to be fixed. So once the problems are known, no more, that's somebody going to fix. Now, the sad thing is that the same software versions are sold today. There has been no security patches. There's a lot of stuff today sold, which is still the same, documented vulnerabilities. Everest is 316 pages of vulnerabilities, more 2 to 3 vulnerabilities per page. And these are still sold and operated unmodified today. The good thing is also that most of the things are not actually fixable by software. There's a lot of hardware issues, so you cannot really go back and even fix that. But still it's shocking that those are sold today. And those are actually the pictures from Everest when all the different voting machines were having slightly modified firmware.
The report was so short because we ran out of time, not because
we
ran out of all of us.
Also, we started when 1/3 of the time was already lost because of the delays caused by the vendors. So Matt already covered DEF CON. The one thing what I want to say, we really were overcrowded last year. This year, we have 2.5 times larger room for hacking purposes. So it's not going to be hopefully that crowded. This is when, before we started yesterday, this room is 1,000 square feet food room. And this is the picture before we had the opening speech. So we had already before that had to stop people, fire marshal going, this is overcrowded, blah, blah, blah. So this year, the room is 2.5 times bigger. We can facilitate a lot more activity. We are going to be having just yesterday announced DEF CON kits. So we are going to have a voting machine and election hacking challenges for people from 9 to 16. We are going to have a cyber range, which is completely simulated environment, closely mimicking one of the largest jurisdictions in the United States. You can either defend the fort or attack the fort, whichever way you want. That's going to be all 3 days, and that's for training purposes of election officials, as well as people who want to play around with that environment. Again, we were not running an election in last year, so the concentration was in a firmware operating system, physical hardware, and a lot of things were done by just doing that, ripping the firmware out. The next set of people started doing it. As Matt said, the rules were, if destructive testing have to happen, please, if it happens accidentally, it happens accidentally. If you on purpose want to destroy something, come to speak with us. All the rules were honored. We actually got most of the machines still back in working condition after that. So we had a purposeful designated machines, and if somebody needed to rip something apart which is already was destroyed, then we opened another machine to be ripped apart. But we had a tremendous success of preserving as much as possible the machines we had. Now, and by the way, that's also one interesting thing which I have to mention from the previous studies. When we be hacking hell out of the machines for Secretary of State, and after the thing we are returning them, they want to put them back in use. So we don't even know how to clean this. And what do you mean? Hammer. Disruptive testing starts now. DEF CON is all about being informed. So there was no, every machine in the village had already been hacked. We knew they're hackable. We didn't give much of information. So people who came in were mainly unprepared. Yeah. They were unprepared because they didn't understand how obsolete the technology is. Normal, today's JDAC is not backward compatible due to the dates of these machines. And I'm going to have a little bit more of that. So we already knew everything is hackable. This was more to let people to experiment. And again, people found a lot of shit we didn't. I mean, this was really, for me, shocking was the speed. And delightness right. was to see.
Right, 90 minutes after the yeah. door is open.
Well, 90 minutes, no, that's not true. 20 minutes, because he went to listen to the speech before doing the right. proof of concept.
Right.
So 20 minutes after getting, then he went to have a 1 hour speech and then came back and had the demonstration. One thing also what I loved was the vast number of people from the agencies, and especially election officials who came specifically hacked the same machine they use every day.
Yeah.
Because they have never been allowed to examine. They have a contracts, license agreements, whatnot. They have never been allowed to examine. And I just kind of lived through this one guy who came back after spending 2 hours with the machine and say, what am I missing? It cannot be this bad. Anyway, so we didn't run elections. The machines, some of them had all of them, basically nothing was sanitized. I'll have a little bit more about that. But we didn't even try to run election. This was all about looking the hardware. This is us. We already covered this one. And so when the first announcements went out, we started getting copies from letters where vendors have sent letters to the jurisdictions, the county election, trying to say nothing to see here. And one of the claims was that, oh, these guys, first of all, we are trying to stop them by legal injunction, but also these guys have found a couple of stolen machines, which are, you know, from eBay, and we are going to trace where these machines were stolen from, and we will try to find the people who stole them. Well, this is what the eBay looked like, and it looks this today. Really, just the most expensive machines are $2.50 each. $40, $45 gives you a machine which is still today, and in next election will be used in 20 states. So that gives you these are very bulky, so your freight cost is going to be more than the machine cost. So again, claim was made, these machines are stolen. So I went there. And this is the place where I was buying some of the machines. It's in Ohio. In a warehouse, these are probably these stolen machines. Actually, I got the whole story why these machines are there. It was a warehouse where the roof collapsed in the other end of the warehouse. Water damage in the other end of the warehouse. But these machines were intact, and the insurance company still totaled everything. So it was the insurance company who replaced the machines, by the way, the same kind of machines. And so they got a new version of the same shit. And then these machines were sold in that. That was 1,300 machines still unsold at the time. I just heard from a wonderful investigative journalist who had been visiting them last week. They still have 150 machines, thousands sold now. And again, very friendly people. I paid in cash. I get a receipt. I asked, do you ship internationally? Said, why not? But there's more. When we look into the, again, I'm going to get a little bit more about the machine. How am I doing time-wise?
10 minutes.
So, one of the biggest problems of the system is the election service companies. First of all, would you buy a national security level asset from a website which looks like that? The answer is yes. And there's a lot of these companies. Now, I will blow a little bit larger one of the windows there. Our election coding services, time and effort. This is how you buy a national security level services. Wonderful dude. Also, when you click the thing where it says security seals and devices, you get all these locks and stuff. Wait a minute, what is this one? That guy. It is the state of Michigan official seal. That is my hand when I put my personal credit card and ship it to New York. Maybe I was just homesick. I don't know. But the one thing what I was also out of the DEF CON A discovery is how many of these service companies have no security conscience whatsoever. There's no need to social engineer. You give them a credit card and you buy stuff. And and you can buy security seals, you can buy tamper evidence seals, you can buy locks, you can buy keys to the locks individually, because if you lost the lock but you still need a key, whatever. Everything is available. And by the way, for the reason, this is something what we discovered. So we already knew that all voting machines across the United States by the vendor and model have the same key. But then I was very tired and I accidentally took the key from one vendor to another vendor's machine. Compatibility. It worked.
It's the same key in your minibar.
Yeah, it's a key. The number of the key code is 101. That tells you everything. So anyway, when we opened the door, that's what happened. We had the first guy was Charles Schumer. He's a Danish scholar. He got in 20 minutes, did a proof of concept, went to cover the speech, had a proof of concept demonstration after that. While he was doing that, already two teams from Northern California had taken the e-poll books out, and they have Rick Ashley running for, I don't know, which office. And a little bit after that, one voting machine started rickrolling people because it had a media player. You know, things started to get very crazy very quickly. And that's when if there was any doubt in my mind that is this going to work, I was like, yeah, this works. Yeah. this is the e-poll book. By the way, this is an e-poll book which is right now sold. So between 2016 and 2018, the biggest investment in the United States to election technology are e-poll books and voter registration systems. So there's more Rick Astley-friendly devices right now out. So again, what we are aiming to have this year, is that we are going to have more machines which have been never seen before. There will be a lot of firsts possible. And being able to run elections, so you can find all the gaps outside of the areas which we were last time didn't have because we didn't have end-to-end system. Now, about the passwords, which I mentioned, this is also funny. People were trying to start to guess the passwords for ESNS machine, and they found already that service password is SVC, SVC, and they figured out that firmware setting is ULF, ULF, and on they go, went to do guessing until one person found out this website, and the training material came up. Those are all the passwords. Also, the training material says clearly that these are the default passwords. If you discover a machine which has other passwords, reset them back to the default passwords. We found also a document, this is another thing where a vendor says that because of the EAC compliance, the system will ask every month to replace your password. These are the two passwords, alternate between those two. I cannot make this up. Anyway, we had a couple of incidents. We have one whistleblower, as Matt mentioned. The e-poll book has a tiny little hook where you're supposed to put the seal. So when we are giving up the voting machines, I did actually, because I've been looking and hacking that, I knew that if there's something in there should be a red seal. The red seal is easily defeatable, but at least a red seal. So we didn't check. We gave up machines when we didn't see seal. And oopsie-daisy, one of the machines had a compact flash card with 654,000 people's personal details, straight from eBay for $80. So again, this caused obviously we did the right thing with that. But these incidents do happen. And also, none of the voting machines were sanitized. So the previous election was there, but obviously it doesn't have a personally identify information or anything else unless you have something like the timestamp e-poll book from the same jurisdiction. We found from one voting machine an interesting logs. The voting machine had been uploading previous elections with a unencrypted FTP to a domain name which doesn't exist anymore. So there is an investigation, and people are checking out what the hell is going on and why that machine was uploading not only the result, but bulk styles and everything else. There's a lot of things which I'm a little bit covering later. So we didn't give anything else than the raw material, raw machines, and IRDA USB devices and a couple of hard to get what we thought through, but we didn't really realize what all we should have been doing to help people to start. So Twitter account went crazy when people were asking, can I find a PS2 keyboard and whatnot. People were very helpful, were very quickly started having, so the Friday, so Sunday actually was the busiest day because people finally have gathered all the shit they need, and things started to be really progressing fast. Actually, because as I say, JDAC, these are so old that the current JDACs don't work, so this actually was the thing that saved the day, because also everything is so slow that you can actually do everything with just a simple device. So this was used to, basically every single extraction of firmware was done with this. This is an interesting thing because people who haven't seen, this is from ESNS. This is the device where the ballots live, the totals live. This is how you consolidate all the votes in a precinct. It is this weird-looking device. This is when you plug the device in, it powers the computer on or the voting terminal on. And if you don't have this device, the terminal doesn't turn on, and so it's impossible to do anything. Unless you get the super secret material called magnet, and you put a magnet in, that actually might be Matt's hand.
No, that's Micah's.
Okay.
That's my Palm Pilot.
So yeah, and the communication method is IRDA. Yeah.
Out of a
So what could possibly go wrong? Anyway, that's to explain why we did provide IRDA devices, because we thought maybe people don't today travel with those anymore that much. But this, this tells you how trivial it is. This is just the feelings, how a point of origins are marked clearly in places. This is the actual IRDA device from inside. And basically, in the last 2 minutes, why we didn't have all of these discoveries in when we had 2 months? In a previous authorized studies, we still have a rules of engagement. We didn't have freedom. We still had things would limit our speed. So we didn't have that kind of freedom, which we were delighted to give to the community and let them try out. So there are reasons why we didn't find these things, and it's good to understand that when we were worried about DMCA, you always forget that the foreign actor who is trying to destroy the trust to democracy probably won't care about breaking DMCA in the process. And we might get sued. And this is the last thing, it keeps on giving. 2018 is bigger floor space. We are going to run in elections. We will have a couple of follow-up speeches. For example, one researcher found that the firmware contains a media player playlist of Chinese songs in every voting machine. I don't know. It's something what made me wonder. And so welcome next year. It's going to be fun. It's going to be crazy. It's going to be very hot and sweaty, but that's what it is. And I think this is something what Matt did.
Yeah.
No, not me at all.
So, someone else did.
Yeah. So just quick words to wrap up, because we have like negative time left before the next talk has to set up. I think we might have time for like two questions, but I want to close with where do we go from here? So one thing that is quite clear is these machines are made of software. Software is terrible. We know software is terrible. Probably the most important advances in what do we actually do to get secure elections are two technologies that have been proposed, which are kind of considered the state of the art. The first is called software independence, or strong software independence. It's a concept Ron Rivest, the R in RSA, came up with. It basically said it was a design criterion for voting systems. And we said a voting system should have the property that the outcome should not depend on software.
And an example of a voting, it doesn't say you can't use software anywhere. It just says that the outcome of the election shouldn't depend in any way on the correctness of the software. And one way of achieving that, for example, is with optical scan paper ballots. Why? Because you mark a ballot with by hand, without a computer, or with perhaps an assistive device that marks it for you, a paper-printed ballot. You can run that through a reader at the polling place, and that reader might reject your ballot if you inadvertently vote for two people for something that you're only allowed to vote for one, so you find out if you misvoted. And keeps a tally of what's going on, but then captures the paper ballot in a basket that's locked, and as long as you maintain the chain of custody of that, you have that artifact of what the voter did. And then what you do is a second important advance called a risk-limiting audit, which is essentially a statistical method for sampling all of the ballots to see if the electronic count matches a hand count with those ballots. And if it doesn't, you do more audits or recount everything in order to recover the true vote. So there is an alternative. I mean, one conclusion you can reach is either, wow, this is great, I'm going to be president because I know how to hack these voting machines, or despair, what are we going to do? But in fact, there are paths forward. So in addition to encouraging you to learn how these voting systems work, come to Las Vegas if you want this summer, or buy voting machines yourself and hack them, absolutely, we need more people doing that. Also, advocate for systems that don't depend on software, that don't have these dependencies on really a fundamentally unreliable technology. And a lot of states are already moving in that direction. This is actually a battle we're winning. We need smart technologists like everybody in this room to understand this and advocate for it. How do I get started is the question I almost always get asked. Let me strongly recommend, in addition to understanding how hacking voting systems work, learn how elections work. And the best way, and when I say learn how elections work, I mean at the real on-the-ground detail of how do actually votes get cast and counted in a real jurisdiction. And the best way to do that is to become a poll worker. Almost every county in the United States that has in-person elections desperately needs people to work on election day. You get trained in what happens, and you get to be the poll worker. And best of all, you get to hand out those coveted I voted stickers to people after they voted, and everybody loves you. And most importantly, you get to actually see firsthand this process. And the details of this process matter a lot. They're really absolutely critical. And you meet the people who are actually running the elections in your jurisdiction. And those relationships are just golden. You want to be the person they know to call when they have tech questions. So anyway, thanks very much. I think we have time for zero questions before they bring the hook out. I think it's zero questions. I can't actually see a thing, so I have no idea if anybody's still in the room or what. But okay. Anyway. Oh, wow, there are people still here. Great.